Hello, and welcome to the Preview Spotlight Interviews on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
And I'm Bob Brutal. In this episode, we'll be talking with creators about upcoming projects available in the current month's previews catalog.
Okay, the first person we interviewed this month was Rick Remender. He's got a new series, actually a new miniseries coming out from Dark Horse called Gigantic, and it looked pretty interesting and cool, so we decided to talk to him about that to find out more about it.
And next we have Stephanie Gladden, who is the artist on this year's latest installment in the Jingle Bell series, which is Jingle Bell, Santa Claus versus Frankenstein. And that is, of course, as always, written by Paul Dini. And we chatted a little bit with Stephanie about that book.
And Bob and I are both big fans of Love and Capes. So when we saw that there was a trade paperback coming out, we had to talk to Tom Zoller about that. And one thing that's interesting to note is while he's self-publishing that title still through Merkle Press, the trade's coming out from IDW.
And then finally, we wrap up this episode talking with a creator of a web strip called The Original Nutty Funsters, Stephanie O'Donnell. And you can look at the show notes to see how to get a hold of this online. And you can also buy a printed version of it also with one of the links on our show notes that are to her website where she is selling this book. But it's fun to talk about this sort of thing every now and again. And let us know what you think about that, because we can cover some things that aren't always just in previews, but that are comics related, and maybe they're self-published or web strips or things like that. So if you'd like to see a little more breadth in what we cover, please go onto our forums at www.comicbookpage.com or send us an email at theguys@comicbookpage.com. And with that, let's get into the interviews. Okay, and we've got with us here Rick Remender, who has a new book coming out in the September previews, Gigantic. And that one looked very interesting to us, Rick. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Gigantic and what it's all about?
Gigantic kind of grew from my love of giant monsters, and came from a place where, you know, looking at all of the old Ultraman stuff and Godzilla and Mothra and all the great kitschy Japanese monster stuff and robots, aesthetically, like with nothing else, just how it looks. I wanted to do something with that, and it had sort of been rattling around upstairs for a while. I think idea for what gave it some substance and the actual idea behind it came a little bit later. And the idea behind it is it's basically it's the Truman Show with a superhero in a sense. It's sort of focusing on a brainwashed alien superhero who's been deposited. He's been deposited here on Earth to be the spotlight of an intrusive around-the-clock television program that's being filmed, and he's got absolutely no knowledge of this, and it's being broadcast universally. So as the plot unravels and we see what's going on with the character, there's also, it's 50% giant robots fighting bounty hunters and destroying cities, and the other 50% is sort of the intrigue and finding out, Earth itself is just nothing but a stage for a reality TV program that we're all dialed into. There are, literally trillions of little cameras all over the planet, and the planet itself was built by the UBC, this United Broadcast Company, in order to film us. We are genetically engineered to be smart enough to create great weapons and primal and savage enough to use them to make us for good television. So Gigantics come here with a few different motivations. Well, without giving away too much of what's going to happen, he has a connection to Earth, and for the past 30, 40 years, he's been a gladiator arena champion, another big show in the universe where they basically drop ultra, warriors in this huge stadium and have them, kill one another, sort of a modern-day equivalent of the Roman Colosseum. So as this unravels and we get to meet the character and see where things are sort of leading to with that, we also there's a lot of big reveals in the nature of the universe, which is a lot of fun to sort of come up with solutions and answers to what the meaning of life is in the context of a monster comic.
Now, is this an ongoing series or is this a limited series?
We're going to be doing it in 5-issue chunks, and the idea right now is the first 5 issues are self-contained, so the story has a beginning, middle, and end, and where it's left is wide open for the next one, and then the idea is to give us a couple months off and then to return to it, so maybe handle it like BPRD or Hellboy.
So you'll be doing, as opposed to how you're doing Fear Agent, where you have the arcs like Eye Against Eye, which is ending up with part 6 this month, but that's Fear Agent number 27. You'll have like Gigantic colon some name, and it'll be some different series. And just go 1 through 5, kind of like Hellboy, like you example, that does
right.
That
on,
same
on,
thing.
On
you'll
Fear Agent, we ended up kind of mixing the two up a little bit because people who had been longtime readers were confused by the Last Goodbye, which was our first Dark Horse miniseries.
Right.
And so what we did was to add the miniseries numbering and the ongoing numbering on the cover, and people have really liked that. For something like Gigantic, that's not going to be like a monthly comic book. We're going to be doing 5 issues, 5-10 issues, like every year and a half, whenever we can make it happen. And they'll always be self-contained arcs so that you can, read one without having to necessarily have read the other one. And that way, it's not going to be – the monthly grind gets to be, pretty crazy. And I'm also – beyond juggling Fear Agent, I'm also doing the End League at Dark Horse, which is my monthly superhero book, which we're getting caught back up on. The new artist came in to pick up for where Matt Broom had kind of dropped the ball on the deadline. And issue 4 will come out next week, and then issue 5 of the End League comes out a month after that. But then I've also got the Punisher at Marvel. I've got a few miscellaneous projects at DC, including Booster Gold 13 and 14, which are coming out October, November, and a new project. So I've been pretty buried.
Yeah, no kidding. And we've got the Rick Remender pages here in previews this month. If you turn to pages 34 and 35, listeners, you can find Gigantic, Fear Agent, and End League there. And certainly look around for Rick's work elsewhere at Marvel and DC, as stated. But this one really caught my eye because I like how you're bringing some of the sci-fi back to comics. There hadn't been that many sci-fi books. And Fear Agent really, for me, filled a void there. And now this one, kind of the giant monsters with the sci-fi angle, sounds really fun. And I was really intrigued by this when I saw I saw the online solicit for it. And I said, oh, it looks cool.
Yeah, and fun is sort of the important thing about any of this stuff. The series are supposed to have a dramatic element that'll rope you in and make you care about the characters. But if the aesthetic, there's all this classic pop culture stuff in the zeitgeist floating around, and it's so much fun to take the aesthetic and the idea of something, but put an entirely new and modern spin on it, because it does dial into all that stuff that we dug as kids and all that stuff that we were, inoculated with growing up.
Well, and again, like you were saying, the whole Ultraman kind of look and feel to it in places and stuff is kind of cool, too. So how heavily are you kind of pulling in the Japanese influence on some of this?
Pretty much like I said, it's solely an aesthetic issue at this point. Storytelling and pacing, any of that stuff, it's all very American. It's all very, pulp-derived. And I think that the story itself should immerse you. The first issue is him arriving on Earth, and I didn't want to just move past that. It would have been too easy to go, hey, a giant guy shows up on the planet, and now he's off on his adventure. I wanted to focus on a giant guy shows up in the middle of San Francisco, and what would happen with that? He's off kilter. He's out of, he's off balance. He didn't expect to be, 50 feet tall when he arrived here. And so that first issue is the tone and the theme are confusion and chaos as he's stumbling around San Francisco trying to get out of the city, and there are things in his way. And so it's aesthetically you know, that's the same as Fear Agent. Fear Agent's aesthetically derived from Wally Wood and a million other, you know, amazing sci-fi guys from the 50s. But the storytelling is modern. You know, it's inspired by my love for, I think Fear Agent, more than anything else, would have to be inspired by my love for Frank Miller. You know, without trying to, I try not to be derivative of that, but that's definitely where a lot of the inspiration comes from. So Gigantic, I would say, if anything, I've been reading a lot of Grant Morrison lately, so I'm trying to open up and be crazy and let things be a little more less linear and focusing on moments that might normally get passed over that might be interesting to focus on. So it's got the aesthetic of Ultraman, Godzilla, and all that fun stuff with a more modern storytelling sensibility that isn't necessarily dialed into any of the Japanese culture stuff.
Cool. It sounds like a lot of fun.
I hope it is, yeah.
That was the general idea. So, again, you know, we really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to talk to us, you know, writing all those series at the same time. You've got to be busy. But getting people to give this a look-see, because it really looks like it's fun. And anyone who's ever watched one of these giant monster movies or anything like that, I would imagine also – if you ever seen some of the, it seems to me like, you know, callbacks to some of the like giant robot kind of thing, and you know, Johnny Sacco. Did you ever watch any of that, Rick?
No, I didn't. I haven't seen Johnny Sacco. No.
Okay, he had a big giant robot, and they'd go around. But you know, that's the kind of thing that I saw this, and I was like, okay, that was fun. This looks fun too, and
right.
Certainly I like the other stuff that you write. So this was right up my alley for picking up.
Well, I hope you like it. We've put in a lot of work on it, and I think it's going to be a real fun book.
Very good. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys.
And we have with us in this segment Stephanie Gladden, the artist on the upcoming Jingle Bell Santa Claus versus Frankenstein. And I've been a fan of the Jingle Bell stories Paul Dini has been putting out for quite some time, and I have some familiarity with Stephanie from Facebook. So when I saw this one coming out, I said, hey, let's talk to Stephanie about the latest installment in Jingle Bell. So why don't you familiarize our listeners a little bit, Stephanie, with the character of Jingle Bell?
Well, sure. Jingle Bell is Santa's bratty teenage daughter, and no one really knows about her because, well, frankly, he's a little embarrassed by her and by her, you know, outrageous behavior. But deep down, she has a really good heart, you know, because, well, she's a Claus. You know, she is her daddy's little girl, so, you know, deep down, she has a good heart. But she's going through a teenage phase where, you know, she wants to be different and she wants attention. So she just makes some poor decisions like any teenager would.
Okay, so this particular installment really kind of arched my eyebrow when I saw it, because it's Santa Claus versus Frankenstein. So
that's right.
We don't want to give away any spoilers on the issue. We don't want any specific details or anything. But if you can kind of give like a high level, you know, view of what this story is going to be about, that will kind of grab the listener into saying, hey, that sounds like fun. I want to read that book. Let's see if we can hit something like that.
Well, I personally believe it's been a long time coming to see Santa battling it out with Frankenstein myself. But the gist is, at the end of the Mary Shelley Frankenstein, he is lost in the Arctic. You know, in the actual novel, he goes to the Arctic, and there he is frozen. And it is there, at the North Pole, that Jing finds him frozen. And she just takes an instant fascination with him, takes him to the workshop, thaws him out, and is trying to figure out how to sort of rehabilitate him. And as a result, he becomes a honorary elf, which doesn't really work out too well because, let's face it, he's Frankenstein. And I guess wacky hijinks ensue.
That sounds like it's fun.
Apparently, it's like, you know, when he starts to make toys, it's just a disaster.
Right. So the general Jingle Bell stories, they're, the art style is usually more of the kind of, I'll describe it as more of the animated type of style. And it's not the photorealistic one. Am I doing that justice, or am I using the wrong terms there? Is that?
No, you're doing it right. You know, Paul Dini generally likes to find artists whose drawing styles kind of evoke a sort of, you know, more of a classic animation and comics style, you know, characters that look a little bit more animated and more rounded. You know, for the first books, he was using Stephen DeStefano and, you know, Bill Morrison and Jeff Bone, if I recall correctly. And he just sort of, he kind of likes that look. And it's also because he wants them to feel like the old, you know, those old Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer comics, you know, those giant-sized digests that used to come out at Christmas time.
Right. That's a good way of putting it, because what I like about Jingle Bell is that, you know, and it's always nice, you get the Jingle Bell story around Christmas time. This will be coming out around, you know, I don't know, it's solicited for the November preview, so probably around Thanksgiving time, you know, end of November, early December, it'll be out. And, you know, that's the time of year that you're getting in that Christmas mood and you want to read this kind of story. And the art style does set it apart from a lot of the other comics on the rack, and I think it really evokes, you know, the kind of, I don't know, joy, you know, or just kind of joyful abandon of the character Jingle Bell, because she, like you said, she means well, but just crazy stuff happens as she's going along, and you know, very humorous stuff as well. But being told with the animated style, or, you know, the rounded style, it just gives it a really nice feel that sets it apart from other things that you're going to be seeing on the rack.
Well, I think so. It's, you know, that sort of, yeah, that really rounded drawing style is something you, well, you just don't see a lot of right now. And also it also gives it the feeling of being more of an all-ages book, too, which is you know, something Paul also likes to, you know, invoke with Jingle Bell.
Yeah, which is another very good point, because this is something that if you've got kids, or if you've got cousins or brothers or sisters, depending on what age you're at, you can get these Jingle Bell comics and you can generally sit down and read them with the kids. You're not going to, I'm assuming, you're not going to find Frankenstein like picking somebody up and ripping him in half or anything like that.
You know, I seriously doubt that. I mean, don't get me wrong. Sometimes Jingle Bell does some pretty crazy things. Like last year, she did decide to open up a casino like Tahoe and make it a Santa Claus North Pole themed casino. But it was still pretty family friendly, even with all the stuff that happened there. And you know, so sometimes, it's just a funny book. You know, she, like I say, she's always trying to think of ways of bringing Santa, make him shiny anew for the 21st century, and it just never really quite works.
So, when you're drawing this book, do you do anything special to get yourself in the Christmas mood? You're drawing Santa Claus and you're drawing the North Pole and the elves and Santa's workshop and stuff. Do you put any Christmas CDs in the tape in the machine and get some Christmas music going? Or what do you do to get yourself going to draw this?
Oh, I'll probably be listening to a few Christmas tunes to get started. And of course, as they keep pushing the Christmas season on us earlier and earlier and earlier, you know, I'm sure I could actually go into, like, you know, the local, you know, garden center and see Christmas stuff out, you know, before Halloween even shows up, which will also, you know, help me put me in the mood. In fact, that'll actually be even more entertaining, because since Frankenstein is in it as well, going to a store seeing both Halloween and Christmas being, you know, pushed at the same time, you know, will be just the right mix, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, I, you know, sometimes I listen to Christmas tunes, but really with Jingle Bell, I just try to get into her head and just draw her. You know, the fact that she's Santa Claus' daughter, you know, she's just supposed to be like, you know, a typical, you know, wild teenage girl. You know, she just has very different parents.
So I guess in summary, nice fun book. If you like something that's going to put a smile on your face and make you happy, this is something that you should definitely check out. It's coming out from Top Cow Comics. It's on page 168 of the September previews catalog. And don't assume that your comic shop is going to order big stacks of this book. If it sounds like something that you want to read, make sure next time you're in the shop, mention to the shop owner that this is a book you'd like to buy a copy of, so that you make sure the shop owner buys enough copies for everybody.
Yes.
And I think with that, thank you for joining us, Stephanie. Really appreciate
you
taking the time.
Oh, it was fun.
And we have with us now Tom Zoller, who is the creator, writer, and artist on the wonderful comic series Love and Capes. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the general idea behind Love and Capes.
Well, Love and Capes is a superhero sitcom. It's kind of Mad About You if Paul had superpowers. Where the superhero decides, I love my girlfriend and I'm going to tell her that, but if I'm going to tell her that, I'm going to tell her everything. So it's what kind of stuff happens when your boyfriend is a superhero. What do you do when, you know, is there ever a good time to let your girlfriend know you have X-ray vision? What do you get her for Christmas when she knows you can crush coal into diamonds? Things like that.
So a little different than the Superman Lois thing, because, you know, Mark didn't, like, string Abby along for, you know, forever.
No.
Not letting her know who he was. You know, he's in love with her. You know, he wants to ask her to marry him. So he tells her.
Yeah, that was, as much as I like the Superman-Lois relationship, when they got engaged in the comics and he didn't tell her his secret identity, I don't understand, will you marry me? And then 6 months later, oh, by the way, there's this one thing I forgot to tell you.
Like, being Superman's a important thing in a relationship. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Not like he's going to be constantly darting off to go save the world. Oh, wait.
Yeah, you'd think that would, you know, come up as like, oh, this is my religion, and this is my republic, you know, this is the political party I'm part of, and these are my health issues, and, oh, I fight crime. You know, it would come up.
Yeah, you would think.
I think one other thing that's interesting about this is, while it's kind of a situation comedy, it's not... It seems more low-key on the comedy side. You know, it's got the comedic elements to it, and it's got jokes, but it's not like kind of the laugh-a-minute, zany, you know, kind of slapsticky kind of comedy. It is relatively subtle comedy a lot of times. It's not something that you're just constantly assailing someone with it, because there's a lot of human element to it also. And there's just a lot of what if, because you're exploring the relationship between the two main characters.
Yeah, I think part of that comes from I very intentionally made it not a spoof of comic books. There are a lot of books out there like The Tick or Venture Brothers on TV that do a great job with that, and I didn't want to follow in their footsteps. The relationship is taken very seriously. I liken some of it to the old Adventures of Superman, where Superman would deal with big crises, but he always had this very avuncular quality to him, where it's like, well, you know, I'm going to take care of it. Everything's going to be okay, Miss Lane. So I've tried to keep the superhero stuff, while a lot of it is off page, it's still treated very seriously. It's just the way that people in normal conversation tend to be funny with each other and the funny things that happen based on having that kind of relationship.
Well, and that's one of the things I really enjoy about the book, is it's got that humor and lightheartedness, but like you're saying, you're not making fun of superheroes.
No.
You're walking a very, you know, fine line and doing it very well there.
Well, thank you.
And you do have the, you know, archetypes. You know, you've got, obviously, the Crusader, who's the main hero in this, is kind of the Superman archetype, but he's not Superman, right? And you've got... The Dark Blade is the Batman archetype, and Amazonia is the Wonder Woman archetype. And you can kind of take those, because they're such strong types of superheroes in comics, you can kind of explore those kinds of situations by using those characters. And it it kind of gives you some opportunities to tell some stories, kind of like, what if those superheroes were in a slightly different universe that didn't maybe take itself so seriously?
Oh, yeah. I find working with archetypes is a great shorthand. When I introduced the Crusader, I didn't have to go through a litany of what his powers were and where he got them from and anything like that. When you set someone up as the Superman archetype, people can pick up pretty quickly with what's going on. And it kind of reminds me of Cloverfield in a bizarre way, where I thought Cloverfield was a great Godzilla-type movie, but if they had decided to make that movie with Godzilla, I would have been very upset. So much the same way, I like the Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman aspects that I'm dealing with, but if someone ever decided to write Superman as a straight romantic comedy and cut the superhero stuff out, I don't think it would work. By setting it up in its own universe and dealing with the characters on your own, you have a little more freedom to play with things like that.
I think that's a really good point, because you're invested in Superman. Just like, you know, your Godzilla point's a really good one, because, you know, then people, they'd want to be seeing Godzilla. They wouldn't really want to see these people that are in the after effects of what the monster's doing to the city. You know, if you're seeing a Godzilla movie, you want to see Godzilla. Whereas here, you can concentrate on the relationship between Abby and Mark, and the Crusader sort of incidental, and you see him, you know, do some things, but that's not the main point. Whereas with a Superman book, people kind of want to see Superman all the time.
Yeah, you want to see the action and adventure aspects of superhero books, and by setting it up in its own universe, I mean, my feeling is there are tons of books out there that are doing great superhero stuff. I don't need to try to compete with them. If you want to read Justice League, Justice League's out there and it's a fine book, but they aren't doing the relationship aspect.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And the other thing with your use of the archetypes is what I consider one of kind of the hallmarks of Love and Capes is it is incredibly accessible. I think you could pick up the story at any issue and easily follow along and enjoy what's going on.
Thank you. Tony Isabella and Bob Ingersoll were a couple of my writing mentors when I was coming into the industry. And one of the things they beat into my head is that everybody's comic is somebody's first. Especially doing a quarterly book, I know that people are going to be coming on at all sorts of different times, and it's just in my best interest to make it as readable as possible. With issue 7, I started putting in a recap section, which for the first 6 issues wasn't really necessary, but 6 ends in a particular way that I don't want to spoil because it's the end of the trade paperback at this point. And when I did 7 for Free Comic Book Day, I had to bring people up to speed with what had gone on in the first 6 issues. So I started putting in the recap section so that some of the continuity is a little easier to follow, but honestly, if you miss that section, you could read the book and pick up really quickly.
Yeah, I have noticed that because, you know, I read it as it comes out, and I've never had a problem getting into the flow of the story, just picking it up, even though it's been 3 months and I've probably read something like 500 comic books since the last issue of the story. But I do like the fact that you now have the recap, because, you know, a nice little couple of paragraphs of recap inside the front cover really goes a long way for any book that's not one that's coming out, you know, like clockwork every month.
Right. Well, it's coming out like clockwork. It's just coming out every 2 months.
Yeah. Right. I'm just saying it's that length of time, right? Because just so many other things happen in that period of time.
Yeah. Being an indie publisher, I have to represent the fact I can make my deadlines. I agree completely. And it helps with some of the more plot points. Issue 7 has a joke that very much depends on you knowing who Amazonia is, yet she doesn't appear in the issue. So that was part of why I put the recap in the front. I mean, honestly, you could follow it even if you hadn't read the recap, but it makes it just so much easier, and I don't see why I would want to put any roadblocks into people picking up the book. And I think you guys actually pointed out in reviewing issue 6 that it's a conscious effort to make sure that the characters get named really quickly and you find out who everybody is, and there's always an introduction to the characters in the books.
Yeah, that's a very good point, and I really appreciate that. And I think, as you said, it is a nice method for writers to use that makes their book accessible, and you can tell a good story while still making it accessible to new readers. You know, I don't understand sometimes when you make a book that is kind of cryptic, you're not doing anybody any favors.
Yeah, I want as many readers as possible, so it's in my best interest to, you know, like I said, take all the roadblocks out of their way.
Well, and you also do it without having, you know, tons of expository dialogue or anything. You do it in a fairly subtle manner with how you name the characters, how you reintroduce them, that sort of thing.
It's always a nice challenge to have to do. When I did it in I wrote an action-adventure book called Raider for a while, and it was, I always wanted to make sure the dialogue was as natural as possible. In fact, I tried to, and I think I've done it so far, I could be wrong, but I said I'd never use the words "as you know," because if you know, then you don't need to tell me again. But try to make sure that references are natural and you do things to bring people in and give them the information they need without stopping the plot and, you know, just hitting them with exposition.
Well, one of the other roadblocks that you've removed twice, which I want to mention, is you put up issue, what was it, 4, and I think you're doing it with 7 for Free Comic Book Day?
Correct.
I mean, how can you beat that? You're giving away issues.
Oh, yeah, and it helps. I've noticed it helps on the orders for the next issue. It certainly gets a lot more exposure to the book. And my orders for Free Comic Book Day have gone up over the last 2 years. I think some of it is because I'm definitely doing a family-friendly book and one that appeals to women a little more than a lot of the Free Comic Book Day offerings. So I think, especially from the way it looks and the content of it, there aren't many books that are trying to attack that particular demographic. And in Free Comic Book Day, you've got entire families coming in. It's a good idea to have something for everybody.
That's a really good point. I'm glad you brought it up, because a lot of times you'll see, at least, you know, you go around on the internet on various forums and stuff, and every now and again, the thread invariably gets started up that's like, gee, you know, I read comics and I've got a girlfriend or a wife and, you know, what would you recommend for her? And everyone always pulls out, you know, well, not as much anymore since it stopped coming out, but it was always Sandman and now it's always Fables. But, you know, Love and Capes is a great book that you could give to your, you know, to your girlfriend or your wife to have her read comics if she's interested at all in picking this up, because it's a, like you said, it's a very story driven, relationship driven, not to, you know, characterize all females a certain way, but, you know, even myself, I mean, I like reading this comic because it's such a change of pace from the, you know, standard superhero book of everyone's, you know, kind of beating the crud out of each other. You know, well, it's a nice type of story.
Thank you. I've actually heard stories of comic book fans' girlfriends being the ones to get them into Love and Capes, because they would pick it up at Free Comic Book Day and then say, oh, you have to read this and check it out. So, and part of it just comes from a lot of that entertainment paradigm of TV where there are shows that appeal to women, but they don't not appeal to guys. I mean, Buffy the Vampire Slayer is a great example of it, where it had a huge female fan following, and yet tons of males watched it too. And there's no reason you can't write a book that appeals, you know, you don't need to narrow cast it just because you're trying to target a market. You can actually do something that aims at the market you're looking for and also is open to everybody.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. So just so everyone knows, the trade paperback that's collecting issues 1 through 6 is in the September previews for books shipping in November. It's got issues 1 through 6. It's coming out from IDW, even though the monthly issues come out from your imprint, Miracle. Is that correct? Miracle Press?
It's Merkle. It's
a, Merkle Press?
Yeah, it's my grandmother's maiden name. I named the company after her because she was such a big supporter of mine.
Very nice. And, you know, this trade with issues 1 through 6, go into the IDW section if you haven't tried it out. We should have a special discount on it through DCBS. So if you're a DCBS customer, you'll be able to get a nice price on it. And even if you don't, go to your local comic shop and tell them you would like a copy. They can certainly order it for you and have it when it comes out in November.
It collects the first 6 issues, which is a complete story, and it's got an introduction by Mark Waid.
Cool.
Oh, very nice. Well, thank you for joining us, Tom. We appreciate it, and really want to just expose as many people as possible to this really fun, nice series that you've put out here. And also wanted to thank you for doing it, because I enjoy reading my quarterly installment.
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, we've got with us here Stephanie O'Donnell, who is the creator, writer, and artist on the webcomic The Original Nutty Funsters, or you call it TONF or T-O-N-F?
I think TONF is more widely accepted.
Okay. And tell us a little bit about the strip, you know, kind of high level.
Okay, well, it's basically about three guys, three dudes that are just, you know, they're in the same neighborhood. Not necessarily the best of friends, but they, you know, they just kind of like tolerate each other. They happen to live in the same neighborhood, so they, you know, they kind of have no choice but to be around one another. And, you know, sometimes personalities clash, and sometimes, you know, they get odd neighbors or just odd visitors, and sometimes they'll put their differences aside just to be like, what's the deal with that guy? You know, so it's a lot of it has to do with you know, just personalities and how they mesh together or how they don't mesh together. You know, a lot of social dialogue and hopefully funny that. Yeah. So
let's talk about that a little bit. So if you've got this strip, and it's definitely, just so people know, it's kind of like a classic comic strip kind of format, as opposed to being, yeah, you know, a comic book story, right? You know, you're telling it, and the collection that you've got put together right now is a collection of the strips, but you're really telling those, you know, 2-3-4 panel of continuity, where you kind of have a continuity that goes between them, but you pretty much have, you know, the setup and, you know, the punchline kind of things going on. So, you know, what would you compare it to? If you like this, you would maybe like TONF.
Probably Calvin and Hobbes. It's fairly obvious when you look at my stuff. You would probably think Calvin and Hobbes right away. Probably that. Pearls Before Swine. Maybe a bit of Mutz. But I think it's a little bit more edgier than those strips. Just slightly, but. You know, and it's not really, I wouldn't really categorize it as like quote unquote furry, but you know, they just happen to be cat dudes and rabbit dudes. That's what I call them. They're funny animals. So.
But more so than like when you look at something like Pearls Before Swine, right? Those characters, they're actually little animals, right? Whereas in this one, they're like people that kind of have like a cat head on them or something.
They live in houses. You know, I'm not really sure about their income. Not really sure about what they do, but you know that they must do something in order to have this house. But you know, a little bit of suspension of disbelief. But you know, it's kind of like in, you know, like Tiny Toons or like, you know, in or like in any like those cartoons where like they had houses. They didn't necessarily do anything to keep the house or to, you know, they just had a house, you know.
Right. And I'll give more of a comparison on like an art style, you know, and just the anthropomorphization of them, you know, to Hepcats, if anybody remembers Hepcats, Omaha the Cat Dancer, though not X-rated, you know, and I'm talking more like, you know, you have the animals, but they're wearing clothes, you know, they're wearing, you know, shirts and pants
they're
and whatever.
Very
you
much,
know.
Very much clothed.
Right. And the one guy's got a tail, you know, the tigery one. And, you know, you got the rabbit one. And it's almost like, well, you know, it's set, you know, today in like a sort of urban type of setting where, you know, they go to bars and stuff. So, you know, I don't want to make a direct comparison to Usagi Yojimbo, which is, you know, set in feudal Japan. But, you know, same kind of thing. You know, Usagi and those things, they've got the different kind of animal sort of nature to them. But they're wearing the regular clothes that someone would wear in feudal Japan. And they're going to the same kinds of, you know, shops and restaurants and same kind of situations that one would be in. Same thing here. These guys are, you know, going and doing, you know, they're talking about politics and they're talking about, you know, just relationships and, you know, whatever.
Not so much relationships, more like relationships in the Beavis and Butthead kind of sense.
Well, it's like, it's not deep relationships. It's like,
it doesn't get deeper than that.
I'll agree with you on that. And I guess my point is that you said you don't know what these guys do really. I was kind of like, from that attitude that they have, I was kind of getting the, you know, kind of late college age. Maybe they just got out of college and they got some kind of low-level job because it seems like that's their main pursuit.
Yeah, probably. That sounds about right. I don't know about D so much. He seems a little bit more blue-collar. He's kind of got that blue-collar vibe.
Early 20s.
He would have been at a Judas Priest concert.
Yeah.
Well, why the decision to go anthropomorphic to begin with?
I think it's just the way that I just watched cartoons. It's just the way that I was, you know, influenced by them. Like I would watch, you know, old Warner Brothers cartoons. I'd watch Tiny Toons. I'd watch Animaniacs, which is where I got the title Nutty Funsters from. And a lot of that stuff was a big, big influence on me growing up. And it was like that and, you know, Calvin and Hobbes, you know, like that. Like that kind of amalgamation, just kind of, I suppose it was a recipe for disaster, but you know, everybody sees things in their own way.
Well, it certainly helps set it apart from a lot of the other stuff. If you had gone with just, you know, regular looking people, it would have lacked the visual style. So yeah. I can see that.
Yeah. I mean, I can draw people too. I mean, I have. But I just think, like, I wanted Nutty Funsters to be, like, its own separate entity. I wanted it to be its entirely different, its own little enclave of, you know, people that happen to look like that. And, like, and that's, like, a totally normal thing. Like, nobody thinks different of it.
Cool.
Yeah, and I guess it gives you kind of a shorthand, too, you know, on what people, you know, you can make in a small strip, right, especially when you don't have – you're telling it in little 3-4 panel chunks.
Yeah.
You know, you can kind of visually distinguish these people very easily from one another.
Yeah, I tried to before when I first started. I've been doing this for like 4 years now. When I first started it, it was just very primitive looking. And one of the major complaints that I would get is like, oh, I can't tell the characters apart. And I'm like, oh my God, I gotta do something about that. So I hope I'm evolving. So it's.
Oh, you definitely see from the beginning. Like if you get the trade that you've got for sale, and we'll put a link to your website in the show notes.
Okay.
And your MySpace page also. And you have the trade of the first. How much of continuity? About pretty much the first 3 years, 4 years.
No, it's all stuff from 2007.
2007. Okay, so you got a year worth of strips in there.
Yeah.
And it's 74 pages.
It's about 80 pages.
Okay. And how much does it cost?
It's $7.95.
Okay, and that is available on the website. You can get that continuity. You can also read the strips online at the link again that we're going to be providing. And you put up a new strip how often?
Like every Wednesday.
Okay, so we get weekly.
Yeah.
Very good. Do you prefer – because I found you on Facebook, right?
Yes.
And I get like the – you send out the nice little reminders when a new strip comes up. And
yeah.
I haven't been paying close enough attention to notice that it's every Wednesday
okay.
that I get an email from you. But
that's okay.
I do know periodically I get the – there's a new strip up. And, oh, neat. And I click on it and I'll go read it. And,
oh, okay. Thank you. I appreciate it.
If you're a MySpace friend to you, you get the same kind of note.
Yes. I put out bulletins. I put it up on the blog, so and sometimes I worry like if I do it too much, but I'm like, you know, you have a product, you gotta, you know, shill, you know.
Absolutely. And I do the same thing, you know. We put up new episodes of the show, and when a new episode goes up, I put out a message about it. And my way of thinking is it's real easy to delete something that you don't care about. You know, you don't have to read it.
Exactly. If you don't like it, then, you know,
yeah.
You know what to do.
Exactly. But, you know, it's nice because it reminds me, you know, it's like, oh, a new one's up. Cool. Because I personally like the push model where you tell me something new is out there, whereas other than me having to go and check and look for it. So I try to put
in as much information as possible, you know, just to make it easier on the reader or the viewer.
Very good. So I will encourage everyone to give it a shot. You know, it's a nice it's a quick read, you know, for a weekly thing. You know, you got 3-4 panels on a given week and, you know, minute or so. But, you know, a lot of times you'll get a chuckle out of it and give it a shot. check out Stephanie's MySpace page, check out the website. And thank you for coming on and joining us, Stephanie.
Thank you for having me.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.